I was sitting in a small conference room with four other people. We were all preparing for some form of ministry. Episcopalians, UUs, even a Presbyterian. And we were all required by our denomination to be there. All of us seeking some form of official recognition as some kind of minister. Each of our denominations required a career assessment. And a company in Columbus, Ohio provided them. We took a bunch of personality tests. And my favorite was this 500 question test that required a little prompting before we walked into the testing room. We were told, when this test asks you about hearing voices and seeing visions, it is being literal. Do not interpret anything figuratively. We laughed and I made a joke. And though I understand why we were warned, I never forgot that moment. See, we were there to talk about our call. And there's a tendency in religious writing to use very strong metaphor when talking about call, especially when we interpret the life around us symbolically. And when we're stepping into a more prophetic role, that tendency can run a little wild. Ezekiel. And I looked up, and behold, a whirlwind came out of the north, and a great cloud, and a fire enfolding upon itself, and brightness was about it. And out of the midst thereof is a color of amber, out of the midst of the fire. And also in the midst there came a likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one had four wings. And their feet were straight feet. The sole of their feet was like the sole of a calf's foot, and they sparkled like the color of burnished brass. Daniel said, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven, churning up a great sea. Four great beasts, each different from others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on two feet like a human being. And the mind of the human was given to it. Zechariah. Then I looked up, and there before me were four horns. I asked the angel who was speaking to me, what are these? He answered, these are horns that scattered Judah, Israel, and Jerusalem. Then the Lord showed me four craftsmen. I asked, what are these coming to do? He answered, These are the horns that scattered Judah so no one could raise their head. But the craftsmen have come to terrify them and throw down these horns of the nations who lifted up their horns against the land of Judah to scatter its people. And these are only three examples from the Hebrew Bible. And though even though some form of prophetic witness stands in most religions, some form of prophetic writing that relies heavily on metaphor and allegory. Of course, the most popular one in modern Christianity involves the revelation of Jesus Christ brought to St. John on the Isle of Patmos. It's a neat book. It's full of amazing imagery. And one of the purely scriptural examples of a specific genre within the Christian canon. Based off of statements from Irenaeus, the writing could be anywhere from 71 to 96 CE. Either under the reign of Claudius or Domitian. And I was always taught to, and I tend to lean towards the later date of the writing, around 96 CE. In fact, most of this goes a little further down the rabbit hole than I intended to go. My intention is actually to talk about genre. And as you know, literature is not birthed into the void. It's born into a world with a context and a purpose, which is also affected by the author and the editor's of personal style. Genre is defined as a category of artistic composition, as in music or literature, characterized by similarities in form, style, or subject matter. Revelation is a very fun and exciting genre known as apocalyptic literature. Most specifically, Jewish apocalyptic. In fact, many Christians writing the theology books in the genre itself defined the genre by this book in a few chapters in Daniel. But it is a fun and exciting read, especially if you look at the other titling options for the book of Revelation. My favorite titling option for the book of Revelation is the Apocalypse of Jesus Christ by St. John. In fact, the Greek word for revelation, as intended in the writing of this book, is apocalypsis, which is a cognate to the modern term apocalypse. A term we all know well if we like movies, TV, or books that circulate through the science fiction genre. If you watch The Walking Dead, Falling Skies, The Last Ship, or 100 on television, or The 100, or The Hunger Games, The Maze Runner, or any other zombie movie that comes out, you're watching a variation of the apocalyptic genre called post-apocalyptic, in that they happen in a world after a major ending or changing event. However, I must be clear, this interpretation of the term apocalypse is not necessarily consistent with the genre of Jewish apocalyptic written from 200 BCE to about 100 CE. In fact, Jewish apocalyptic has little to do with the end of the world and more to do with the end of suffering. The most traditional and earliest apocalyptic literature is written in light of suffering and pain as a comfort and a reminder that the people of God are not alone or forgotten, that their pain and suffering will come to an end, and so will those who cause it. There is a social context that created the milieu of suffering for Christians at the end of the first century, and that was the situation that birthed the book of Revelation. And when taken out of that context, it has been interpreted to mean a lot of different things. And it's only out of context that movies like The Omen, Rosemary's Baby, or The Seventh Seal make any sense. But at its core, it's a simple letter that says, things are going to change. I can feel it. But if I begin to descend into the social context, I'll never get to where I'm going. And where I'm going is a small town in Mississippi called Nesbitt. You can get there by exiting I-55 on the South Hernando exit, but I always preferred to get off before that in Coldwater and ride up Highway 51. Before working here, I worked with hospice in North Mississippi. At the time, it was my calling. I would have said that God had instructed me so, and I interpreted the world around me to reflect that idea. I learned a lot, especially on the business side of hospice, which is driven by terminal diagnosis. There's a list of diagnoses that make a person acceptable for hospice. And all of these diagnoses pointed to one thing: some form of massive infarction of the brain or heart, or both, within the next 6 months. And it was obvious if someone had cancer, late-stage COPD, late-stage Alzheimer's or dementia, that they were hospice appropriate. But sometimes it got more complicated than that. Sometimes the body would just start to shut down, and there was no reason why. There was a dramatic weight loss, diminished cognition, etc., and that would only get worse no matter what. Even though there was no real reason. They called this geriatric failure to thrive. I was sitting with one patient. We were watching Bonanza on TV Land. And as we watched Hoss, Joe, and Adam do whatever it is they do, I was never really a fan of Westerns, we talked about the world around us. She talked about technology, or how she didn't understand it. She talked about the political climate, or how far and how different it was from when she was a child. We talked about family, And even in her Episcopalian background, she couldn't understand the modern interpretation. And over, she would say, "I'm ready. I guess I really don't know what the Lord is waiting for." She talked about the signs that should tip us off to His imminent return, the wars, the rumors of wars. And the words of the old hymn came alive to me while we sat together. "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through. Heaven's not my home, then Lord, what will I do? The angels beckon me from heaven's open door, and I can't feel at home in this world anymore." She'd seen everything she wanted to. In the world of that day, didn't have anything left for her. In fact, all she wanted at this stage was for Jesus to return so she could go to her home in the sky. It's not my place to judge the perspectives of a 75-year-old daughter, mother, grandmother, friend, and sister. I haven't walked in her shoes, but I've thought about them. I've thought about them a lot to this day. And I think about them often. She and I lived in two different worlds. Because, in fact, this world is my home. The Apocalypse of St. John ends in chapter 22, saying, "For I testify unto every man that heareth the words of the prophecy of this book, if any man shall add unto these things, God shall add unto him the plagues that are written in this book. And if any man shall take away from these words the book of this prophecy, God shall take away his part out of the book of life and out of the holy city and from the things which are written in this book." I was raised in a tradition that took that scripture specifically, and ran with it. They demanded that Revelation was sealed. At the time, there was sealed at the time of direct revelation from God, and is passed in any personal revelation rests within the pages of this book. That there is nothing more to be said, and it all has been learned here. That God, this God that loved her people, had nothing more to say. I never felt comfortable with that. It would seem to me that to believe that, I would have to remove the apocalypse from its initial context, which is comfort when the world is falling apart. Comfort knowing that the oppressed can rise and be greater than their masters, that there is something larger than us, that love matters. I couldn't imagine a book that sits as a reminder that God is watching and working towards the goals of her people that ends by telling us that we should never think outside of those pages again. That Revelation is dead. That sounds too much like a spiritual failure to thrive. John Luther Adams wrote, "Religious liberalism depends first on the principle that revelation is continuous. Meaning has not been fully captured. Nothing is complete, and thus nothing is exempt from criticism. Liberalism itself, as an actuality, is patient of this limitation. At best, our symbols of communication are only reference and do not capture reality. Events of the word, deed, and nature are not sealed. They point always beyond themselves." As I look into the world, it's important to know to the best of my ability what I see. It's easy to look out and see the struggles of humanity, the hunger, the suffering, the injustice, and the uselessness, and conclude that we can't change it. It's also easy to look out and see the beauty and the joy and the laughing, the recent victories that we've made, and ignore the suffering. But if we're to be prophets, if we're to bring comfort, we must look at this reality that echoes the biblical writer Qohelet and say something like, there is new creation every day, but there is also entropy. We must build new, better social organizations that bring justice and equity and remove those that no longer help us move forward. We must know our history, the good and the bad, but not rest on the laurels of that the past has wrought us. Because there is a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to scatter stones and a time to gather them, and a time to embrace and a time to refrain. I didn't know those years ago that I was a Unitarian Universalist. But I knew Revelation was not dead. That I did not live in a world that was intended to stop evolving. I did not live in a world that was bound between the pages of a book. And though I may only be part of a chapter, I knew then and I know now that humanity has the power to write that book into the future. And how do I know? God told me so. Thank you.